The FBI is the most sophisticated law enforcement agency in the world, pursuing the most dangerous criminals. When one of Chicago's worst serial killers commits unthinkable crimes against women.
Imagine your worst nightmare, what you could do to a woman.
The Bureau mobilizes, and the truth they uncover is more shocking than anything they can imagine.
He was such a violent, horrific person inside that shell of normalcy.
What are you wearing while you dismember them? I was wearing nothing. It was too hot.
We needed to stop him from doing this again.
He's like the evil Boy Scout. He comes prepared to commit his crime and get away with it.
FBI, Criminal Pursuit. July 24th, 1995. In the Chicago suburb of Hanover Park, 45 minutes outside of the city, a police officer visits the home of a distraught man. His nieces, 20-year-old Janetta and 22-year-old Emila Pasenbegovic, have vanished. No one has seen or heard from them in 12 days.
Janetta and Emila just disappeared from the face of the earth. They just disappeared.
The beautiful sisters had moved to the United States from war-torn Bosnia just 6 months earlier.
They were the only two daughters of the Pasenbegovic family. The parents were very concerned because of the war that was going on in Bosnia.
Her father and mother basically sent them to live with an uncle in the United States to avoid being attacked.
The hard-working girls found jobs in a local factory and moved in with their uncle. It didn't take long for them to feel cramped by his strict rules and old world ways. After a few months, they pooled their money and got their own place.
They had led very sheltered existences in this war-torn country, and they come here and really, for the first time in their lives, you know, were free. So, you know, they were very bubbly, very excited about American culture and going out and making friends, and very trusting.
They were pretty much normal young ladies doing as much as they can to be on their own and trying to live the American dream.
The girls had been laid off from their factory jobs and filed for unemployment. They were last seen by a friend who dropped them off in a shopping center where they planned to fill out job applications. No one has heard from them since. Investigators begin working the case, talking to anyone who knows them.
They interviewed all family members, the uncle, and people that they were dating or had gone out on dates with in the past, as well as co-workers.
Is it possible the girls have run off in search of a new adventure? Investigators scour the girls' apartment, desperate for clues.
It just looked like they walked out of the apartment to go shopping or to go to a friend's house or something. There was nothing out of place. The only thing that was strange was they had a cat, and the cat was missing. So we thought maybe they went away for the weekend and took the cat with them.
As the days wear on, that scenario seems highly improbable.
It became more and more suspicious, and the more people we talked to, they said this was very unlike them. They always talked to their friends, you know, daily. It was very unusual for them just to disappear without having any contact with anyone.
The mother and father, when they spoke about their daughters, just heartbroken. I mean, they checked in with them every week, even though they were in another country. But the fact that their father hadn't talked to them was clear that they had met with foul play.
There's another reason for authorities' concern. Months earlier, police in a neighboring suburb had begun finding the dismembered body parts of a young woman. Her car was found abandoned in Hanover Park. The woman was clearly the victim of a depraved killer.
This was a vicious, evil person. These murders, there was no reason for it
outside of his own pleasure.
Local investigators needed help and contacted the FBI. Special Agent Brian Bean was brought onto the case.
He had some kind of a mental element that allowed him to continue doing these acts while he was covering his tracks.
Special Agent Bean has been working the case for months and knows that in a city with a metropolitan area of almost 10 million people, it's virtually impossible to track this kind of evil. But now he notices a disturbing link between the Pasenbegovich sisters and the dismembered woman. The woman's car was found not far from the sisters' home.
Well, we learned that the car was dropped off in an apartment approximately a mile from where the two sisters lived in Hanover Park.
Agent Bean's instincts tell him that these cases are related and that something sinister is stalking the suburbs of Chicago.
We believed, based on our talking with a number of investigators, that we had someone who had certainly killed more than one person and was very likely to continue doing so.
FBI Special Agent Jim Gretz joins the search for the missing sisters. He and the team quickly hone in on two co-workers as possible suspects.
We interviewed two associates, one for each of the two girls.
One turns out to be just a friend. The other is a boyfriend. Both men agree to be polygraphed. Agents are hopeful one of them will prove to be more than just a suspect. But both men pass and are quickly cleared of any involvement.
There was really no evidence to point to them other than they did have close social and prior work contacts with the sisters.
It is the first of many dead ends.
We always checked into everything, but everything turned into nothing.
The team refuses to give up. Soon, their diligence is rewarded with another potential lead. Investigators discover that while at unemployment, the girls ran into a former coworker.
Nicole.
Oh, hey.
How are you guys doing?
The woman told them about a man whose wife had a cleaning company and was looking for workers.
There was some exchanging of phone numbers, and the man was given their phone number to try and hook them up with cleaning houses.
We believe that the following morning, a woman picked them up in her vehicle and drove them to a house in Glendale Heights, purportedly for the purpose of pursuing the house cleaning job.
The question is, who was the woman who picked up the sisters? And what happened to them after they disappeared? It will take months before the FBI learns the answers to those questions and begins to realize what a monster they are dealing with. A woman's dismembered body parts have been uncovered in various areas. Authorities found her car in Hanover Park, just 1 mile from the apartment of two sisters, 20-year-old Janetta and 22-year-old Emila Pasenbegovich, who have vanished without a trace. The FBI and local authorities believe the cases are linked and can't help but fear the worst.
By the time that the Pasenbegovich sisters disappear, this is when law enforcement were thinking they've got a serial killer on their hands.
Having fled the atrocities of the Bosnian War, the two girls had been in the U.S. just 6 months.
I actually spoke with their father, and he described how he and his wife walked them to a bus station, and he showed me with his right hand how he waved goodbye to them. He had family here, so their father thought that they'd be safe.
Authorities have no leads except for one. The sisters had contacted a house cleaning company for employment. A friend believes that they got in a car with a mysterious blonde woman.
They were picked up by someone for the house cleaning job, but No one saw that or knew what happened to them.
FBI and local police interview the friend who told the girls about the job. They learn that the cleaning company is owned by a couple, Paul and Charlene Runge. Yet when law enforcement tracks down the Runges, they claim to have no such business.
My wife used to work for a house cleaning service, but we never started one on our own.
And say they never spoke with the Passing Begovich sisters.
I've never heard of them.
No, never heard of them.
He was kind of a salesman. You know, he was very smooth. His wife used to clean houses, but no, he wasn't. They weren't starting a cleaning company, and you know, didn't know anything about the missing sisters.
But law enforcement is suspicious, especially when they learn that Paul Runge is a suspect in the case of the dismembered woman whose car was found near the sisters' apartment. Now, he's also being associated with the sisters' disappearance.
When we saw his name, we knew there might be a lot more to this than just a simple couple girls that went off with friends.
Still, there's no proof that Runge is involved. Authorities continue to keep him on their radar, but cast a wide net for other suspects. More than a year goes by while FBI and police struggle to find out what happened to the Passing Begovich sisters. They're still looking for a suspect when, 20 miles away in downtown Chicago, the fire department responds to a call about a blaze on Toohey Avenue. Firefighters enter the home and discover the body of 30-year-old Dorota Giobach, also known as Dorothy.
We have a female victim, DOA.
Thankfully, Dorothy's 5-year-old daughter was not home at the time and was unharmed. At first, the fire appears to be a random tragedy.
The assumption was, based on the original examination of the crime scene, that there was an accidental fire and she had died within that fire.
But when the medical examiner releases his report the next day, it reveals something much more gruesome.
When the medical examiner came up with a cause of death as suffocation, then we knew that it wasn't an accidental fire. It became an arson.
The means of death is particularly violent.
Dorothy had been strangled and sexually assaulted. Her clothes had been put back on her to cause people to think that it was not a sexual assault, that it was some sort of accident.
After brutally raping and murdering Dorothy, the attacker poured an accelerant on her body and set her on fire. Who is the vicious killer behind this heartless crime? A friend tells investigators that Dorothy, who was trying to sell her house by owner, had an appointment to show the property the day of the murder. That morning, she was chatting on the phone with the friend when the prospective buyer showed up.
Just one second. Dorothy had started speaking in her native tongue to her so that this English-speaking prospective buyer didn't know what she was saying, and she was telling her friend, you know, he's making me very uncomfortable. He was supposed to come back with his wife, and he's here alone. And the friend had actually said to her on the phone, what should I do? Do you want me to call 911? And she said, no, I'm sure it'll be all right, but do me a favor and call me back in 5 minutes.
When the friend called back, Dorothy didn't answer. Panicked, the friend called 911.
911, what's your emergency?
I need you to go check on my friend's house.
She was too late.
At the same time that she's calling 911, the fire department is being called to the house because of the fire.
Who was the visitor at Dorothy's house? It's unlikely that this killing has anything to do with the woman who was dismembered in Hanover Park, or the two sisters who have disappeared. It's been 2 years since a gruesomely murdered woman's car was found in Hanover Park. the same suburb where two Bosnian sisters later disappeared. Now, 45 minutes away, Polish single mother Dorothy Dziubak has been discovered raped, strangled, and burned in her Chicago home.
There was ligature to her wrists. She had blunt trauma to the face as she was being pushed down.
According to Dorothy's friend, a man had set up an appointment to view her house that was up for sale. But despite interviews with friends and neighbors, police are unable to identify or locate him. To compound matters, there's hardly any physical evidence from the crime scene.
Because the original investigators thought it was a death investigation as a result of a fire, there wasn't extensive forensic recovery of evidence.
Chicago police don't know it, but that lack of evidence is eerily similar to the Pasenbegovich case that has stumped the FBI and authorities in the suburb of Hanover Park. Bosnian sisters Janeta and Emila have vanished without a trace, and authorities are no closer to finding out what happened to them. Neither group is aware of what the other is investigating. The FBI's only suspect is Paul Runge, whose wife Charlene allegedly ran a cleaning business that the girls had contacted for employment. Even though Paul and his wife deny any knowledge of the company or the sisters, agents aren't convinced of their innocence.
We kept looking at all these other people thinking, well, what if it is all just coincidental? So we kept looking at everything and eliminating, and it just kept coming back to him, and it's like, he's the guy, he's gotta be the guy.
They dig deeper into Paul Runge's background and discover a shocking and sordid past. At the age of 17, Paul Runge brutally raped and assaulted a 14-year-old girl.
Imagine in your worst nightmare what you could do to a woman, tying over chairs, tying over tables, using poker irons on her, just handcuffing her.
After endless hours of torture, the girl managed to escape and was rescued by neighbors. Runge served 7 years of a 14-year sentence. He was paroled a year before the Pasenbegovich sisters disappeared. This deeply disturbing information puts the investigative team on high alert.
And we start looking at an individual, and you start looking at the background, you start thinking that an individual is not just a one-time offender.
Agents suspect that Runge may have killed not just the Pasenbegovich sisters, but the woman whose car was found in Hanover Park as well. Still, they have absolutely no physical evidence linking Runge to any crime. They search his property, but find little to go on.
We had nothing. We found what appeared to be blood in some of the cars, but not enough that we could utilize for DNA.
Without enough evidence to procure an arrest warrant, the only thing investigators can do is put Paul Runge and his wife, Charlene, under periodic surveillance. For months, they secretly follow Runge and his wife.
We obviously didn't want him to know what we were doing. We wanted to know what his activities were. We wanted to know how he was, you know, what he was doing. If there were more victims they were looking for and so forth.
But Runge is always one step ahead. He spots the surveillance team and their vehicle in the parking lot where he works. After that, the FBI continues to tail him, but the tables have turned.
Runge and Char just absolutely played with him. And at one point in time, she's driving like a bat out of hell from their house. He jumps out of the car at O'Hare Airport, goes flying through the airport with a bag in his hand. And when they grabbed him, they opened up the bag. There was dowels or something in the bag. I mean, he just played them like a fool.
He played with the other surveillance team when they were watching him. You know, he would toy with them.
You guys got nothing on me. Have a great day.
That was the thing. He thought he was smarter.
During the phone conversations, they actually said, "You know, we know you're listening to us."
The surveillance team tries a different tactic. They send in an undercover female agent to the shoe store where Rungi works.
I love those.
Brought our number one sellers.
Oh, they're beautiful.
Yeah, they're gonna look good on you.
Thank you. You have wonderful taste.
Yeah, so do you.
They're hoping she can get him to talk.
Are you from around here?
Yeah. What about you?
Hanover Park.
But he quickly sees through it.
I think someone else should help you.
Made her really quick. It was kind of a shock, but I mean, he was, again, playing games with us because he knew that we were on him.
Tell your friends outside in the car. I said hi.
Despite their intense efforts, authorities cannot nail Paul Rungi down.
Law enforcement, for the longest period of time, believed he was the guy. They also realized that there was no forensic evidence, there was no admissions, there was no eyewitnesses. So they're incredibly frustrated by the fact that though they felt he was the person who committed these crimes, there was not enough evidence to even cause him to be arrested.
Do authorities have the right suspect? If they do, they need to get him off the streets as soon as possible. But if they're wrong, or if there's a second serial killer on the loose, there's no telling who will die next. The FBI's task force is struggling to link its number one suspect, Paul Rungi, to the disappearance of Emila and Janetta Pasenbegovic, who vanished after seeking a cleaning job.
We didn't have solid evidence to obtain an arrest warrant, and that's what gets frustrating now, because now he knows that we are absolutely positively on him, that he is a prime suspect, so then it was just a game.
Though they've been watching Rungi for months, they have nothing concrete tying him to the case. And their surveillance hasn't revealed anything unusual. Is it possible they have the wrong man? February 3rd, 1997. 45 minutes away from Hanover Park, on North Laramie Avenue in Chicago, firefighters extinguish an apartment blaze and discover something dreadful. Lying on a bed are the bodies of 35-year-old single working mother Yolanda Gutierrez and her 10-year-old daughter Jessica Muniz.
It was evident from the scene that both the mother and the daughter were overpowered by one or more people. They were tied with ligature, and their throats were slit, and they were both sexually assaulted. An accelerant was applied to both bodies, and they were set ablaze.
It's obvious that the fire was set to cover up the horrific murders of Yolanda and her little girl.
Jessica was just a little fifth grade girl, and she was a little chatterbox, everybody described her as, and she was the apple of her mother's eye. She was a beautiful girl, and she had such a spirit about her.
Though there are some similarities between this crime and the murder of Dorothy Dewback just miles away, Chicago police don't believe that the killings are connected.
Crime scenes are oftentimes covered up with arson. It's a frequent method of destroying forensic evidence. So although there was that connection, there wasn't anything close either in victimology or pattern that we thought they might be connected.
Police manage to recover semen from young Jessica. They check it against the DNA of her mother's male friends.
Boyfriends or associates. We did extensive buccal swabs of these people, but none of those DNA samples compared to the semen.
Chicago detectives are left with DNA, but no suspect. Back in the suburb of Hanover Park, the FBI and their team have a suspect, but no evidence.
No, we don't have the results back.
We didn't know of the city thing, so we had no way of connecting the two.
Even so, the Hanover team is convinced that Paul Runge might be a serial killer and is involved with the disappearance of Janetta and Emila Pasenbegovic. Investigators continue their surveillance of Runge and his wife, going so far as to pull their garbage.
We met with the garbage truck early in the morning. They would pick up the garbage, put it off the side, and we would grab it.
Wait for the fat boy here.
After nearly a year of unproductive surveillance, Detective Colin finally gets a break.
We found a telephone number, and the telephone number we found was the girl's telephone number.
The girl's names, part of their address, and their phone number are clearly written in Charlene Runge's handwriting. Authorities now have proof that Paul and Charlene Runge are lying about knowing the sisters. The note also clearly implicates them in having a house cleaning service.
I can tell you, being one of the agents in that room, there was a lot of happiness.
Brian Bean let me know, called me up and said, we've got this paper. It was just like, wow, okay.
I flew that piece of paper back to our headquarters in Washington, D.C. I believe it was within 24 or 48 hours. Our main suspect's wife had left a couple of fingerprints on that note. It tied him directly to the disappearance of the two sisters also.
But investigators' elation is short-lived.
Finding the phone number, you know, great circumstantial evidence, not enough to get an arrest warrant.
The piece of paper may not be enough to arrest the Runges, but it is enough to secure a search warrant for their current residence. Investigators are disturbed by what they discover.
The search warrant conducted by the FBI revealed a lot of weapons, actually. They also found a small crossbow, as well as a stun gun.
We were able to find, you know, what we would classify as combat knives or Rambo knives, or it was a knife that easily could have been used in the commission of cutting up a body.
The FBI confiscates the weapons and sends them to their lab for examination, hoping for something that will lock up Runge once and for all. Again, they come up empty-handed.
We didn't find any blood on any of the items that we suspected might logically have blood on them, particularly that knife. We didn't find anything that would definitively tie our suspect or his wife into the disappearance of the two sisters.
After nearly a year of searches and spot surveillance, agents still cannot arrest Paul Runge.
We just never compile enough evidence, and you need hardcore evidence.
They decide to go after the one person they believe can give them Paul Runge, his wife.
We made extensive efforts at trying to gain the cooperation of Charlene.
Yet even while the FBI is trying to crack Charlene, the murders in the city of Chicago continue. In March 1997, another female victim with her home for sale by owner is raped and set ablaze, this time on Kenneth Avenue.
She was found in the bathroom, burnt severely, force blunt trauma to the head, and disrobed. It was obvious homicide with an arson cover-up.
There was a lot of evidence of a lot of resistance being put up. This was a horrific fight.
Chicago police are finally starting to see the pattern between the three fires. Now they too, like the Hanover Task Force, fear a serial killer is on their hands. One who is sadistic and smart enough to cover his tracks.
When you're talking about serial murders, there's a different type. A disorganized one, they just kill and it's sporadic, and just, you know, the crime scene's a mess and stuff. Very organized serial murderers, on the other hand, you know, they need to control every aspect of it.
Chicago police and the FBI are still working separately, unaware that each is pursuing a ruthless sadist. But soon, an old piece of evidence breaks both cases wide open, and a shocking videotaped confession reveals Chicago's worst serial killer since John Wayne Gacy's. While in the suburbs, the FBI is trying desperately to connect Paul Runge to the disappearance of the Pasenbegovich sisters, who have been missing for almost 2 years.
When you're looking at a crime or crimes dealing with the ugliness in life, and you know who did it, it is extremely frustrating not to be able to put those last few things together.
Authorities are certain Runge needs to be locked up. But without enough physical evidence for an arrest warrant, their hands are tied. Agents come up with another idea. A 1996 search of Runge's house yielded a collection of weaponry. Investigators hope their findings will be considered a violation of Runge's parole for the 1987 assault of a 14-year-old girl.
I personally contacted his parole agent and presented information about our findings, particularly about the weapons, to the Prisoner Review Board.
It works. Agents arrest Runge and get him off the streets. With Runge temporarily behind bars, investigators turn their attention to the woman they consider their best bet, Paul's wife, Charlene.
When we found the note in the trash bearing her fingerprints, that implicated her directly, and she and her attorney shortly after that advised us that she was going to begin cooperating.
Charlene agrees to talk in exchange for immunity. What she reveals is horrifying. Charlene confirms that after the Pasenbegovich sisters contacted them for a cleaning job, she picked them up and drove them to her home. While the girls entered the house, she stood outside and smoked a cigarette.
The two sisters thought they were going to clean his Glendale Heights home and found out very quickly that that wasn't the game plan at all.
After a few minutes, one of the two sisters came running out of the front of that house, screaming. And Paul caught up with her, grabbed her around the hair of the head, and basically dragged her back towards the house. She continued to struggle and continued to scream. And Paul slammed her head against the front step of the house several times, and she eventually stopped screaming and stopped struggling. Paul took her back inside the house.
Charlene tells Special Agent Bean that she quickly left and returned that evening to a gruesome sight.
She saw a number of dark vinyl trash bags in the lower level of that house, and she strongly suspected that Paul had dismembered the bodies. And later, he disposed of them in various dumpsters in the surrounding area.
Charlene's confession is a game changer.
Okay, tell me now.
As law enforcement and the attorneys assemble the case against Runge, Chicago PD has a shocking development of its own. Chicago detectives decide to take advantage of new DNA technology and resubmit samples from their unsolved cases. One of the samples is the semen found in 10-year-old Jessica Muniz. This time, it matches someone in the database, Paul Runge.
So we had our men. We knew we could run on them, those homicides.
The DNA link between Jessica and Paul was the first rock-solid forensic piece of evidence that was in all ways conclusive of his guilt.
Finally, the Hanover Task Force and Chicago police realize that Paul Runge is the man they have all been looking for. Investigators come up with a plan to confront Runge, who has no idea his wife has flipped or that there is conclusive physical evidence linking him to the Chicago murders.
The trick of dealing with someone like that is not to insult his intelligence, play up to it, present to him as he's smarter than you until you pull the rug from him.
The FBI strategically interviews Runge first.
He essentially told us that he didn't wish to answer any further questions because he'd already made statements before to law enforcement. And after a very, very brief time with Paul, we thanked him, we left.
Detective Capitelli goes in next and grills Runge about the three fire cases.
He came out, the FBI profiler, saying he agreed with our evidence, but he wouldn't confess. So that indicated to me that Runge was also the playful sort. He wanted to play with us, if you will. He was getting some enjoyment out of this.
Runge vehemently denies any involvement until Capitelli confronts him with the DNA evidence found in Jessica.
And then we showed the final report indicating that it was a 1 in 32 trillion match. And we told him either this was an extraterrestrial from a different universe or you.
Runge finally admits that he did it, but says he's worried he'll get killed in prison for murdering a child. He asks Capitelli if he can be transferred to another facility. In exchange, he offers up the names of his other victims.
So the trick was not only to get him to roll on the one we already knew he did, but all the other ones that the FBI thought he did and the ones we were convicted on.
Bleeding real bad, like this. And I went to the kitchen and found a match, came back and lit it and left.
Runge confesses to the rape and murder of 8 women, including Dorothy, in the city. He reveals that he snuck into Chicago to kill them at times when he knew the FBI wasn't following. He also confirms the FBI's assumption that he killed the woman whose car was found in Hanover Park, as well as the missing Pasenbegovich sisters.
Paul, as a serial killer, was a little bit different than most. He changed his M.O. His first 3 murders were done in one fashion where they were crimes of opportunity, where they were killed on his home turf. However, when he got the attention of the FBI, he moved on to a different way of doing it. He doesn't want to be on his home turf anymore. He's like the evil Boy Scout. He comes prepared to commit his crime and get away with it.
In a chilling confession, Runge freely reveals how he assaulted the unsuspecting Bosnian sisters, obliterating their American dream.
He raped the one girl in front of the other as she was strapped down to his workout table, and then brought that woman up to the bathroom.
He chained her to the tub and turned on the water.
He said she accidentally drowned, but take that for what it's worth. But he dismembered her and then came down and killed the other sister.
Paul eventually took the girls down to the basement area of the house and cut their bodies up and placed them into bags.
Describe for me the saw you used.
Same,
was
same
the
one.
Girl.
The same one.
Describe it for me.
About this long, a tree saw.
Okay.
Started to cut on it. I don't know who, but on the arms here, hands, the arms here, the ankles, the legs, and then here.
Did you dismember their heads?
No.
What motion did you have to use in order to do that?
Just like cutting the tree.
How much force did you have to use in order to dismember them?
Less than a tree branch.
It's so horrible. I mean, they had gone through so much before they came here, and it was just like, you know, they had an opportunity for such a great life here, but he took that away from them.
Hour after hour, Paul Runge calmly details his reign of terror for investigators.
This is a part of the homicide confession by Runge of Yolanda Gutierrez and Jessica Muniz.
Laid her down on the bed, and the mother and her daughter came over, laid on the bed over here on the other side, And then I took the duct tape out of the pocket and I taped her hands behind her back and then the little girl's hand behind her back.
And you'll notice again, this is an horrific act where he describes neither the mother or daughter whimpering, yelling, complaining, just laying there stable without emotion as he goes about and kills the mother in front of the daughter and then the daughter. No emotion at all. It's amazing. Now here he's showing exactly how he cut the throats of the mother and the daughter, placing his hand on the back and then slitting the throat.
There was gurgling sounds from her neck. She didn't say anything. And there was blood that came out when I put that out.
When Paul Runge was describing these horrific acts, he described it as if he was swatting a fly away. Really, he had removed himself.
He was evil. There always seems to be some emotion when a homicide offender or murderer confesses. Runge, nothing. It was like looking into a deep, deep, dark hole. Nothing.
In 2006, Runge is convicted of the murders of Yolanda Gutierrez and her daughter, Jessica Muniz. He is sentenced to death. 5 years later, the state of Illinois abolishes the death penalty. Runge's sentence is commuted to life without parole. For the FBI and investigators, Paul Runge is in a class all his own.
I would say Paul Runge is one of the worst sexual predators that has been around.
He presented himself as so normal. When you looked at him, he's part of the wallpaper. He's not someone you'd look at and say, we ought to be very careful around this guy. So what amazed me was he was such a violent, horrific person inside that shell of normalcy.
There is no doubt in my mind, based on what happened, this individual may have gone beyond being evil.
This now concludes the statement of Paul Runge.